event, the magazine enjoyed enough status to help stave off additional confrontations. Buchanan relented, and Hyde begrudgingly backed off. Shortly afterward, Hunter Thompson found himself talking to another young Nixon staffer, Nick Rui, the advance man for New Hampshire. Together, they sat down for a drink. Rui, an Ivy Leaguer from Detroit, was happy to go into detail about the nature of his position, one that Thompson soon began to realize played an integral and often overlooked role in any candidate's attempt to capture a primary. As an advance man, Rui didn't just scout out locations. He also prepared Nixon for the many unexpected variables that might develop, all the while making sure not to upset his boss in a manner that might negatively influence how things would unfold next. In this sense, a great advance man was like an elite horse trainer or fight manager, a tactician and spiritual guide and ceaseless motivator all rolled into one. Rui was honest and relaxed, not easily offended. They talked in depth. Eventually, Thompson asked him about the choice of the Holiday Inn. Why go with a hotel that gave off such a Soviet barracks feel, as opposed to, say, the more alluring Wayfarer, which was located on the outskirts of Manchester? Rui smiled. We left that for Romney when we found out that it's owned by one of the most prominent political operators in the state, a Democrat. Romney was at that time Nixon's chief primary opponent. George really stepped into that one. Thompson was fascinated. Most people had never even heard of an advance man, and it was a position that the press rarely wrote about, which made sense. For someone like Nick Rui, things were at their best when no one stopped to notice the part he'd played and how it all turned out. Eventually, Rui mentioned a get-together for some journalists and Nixon staffers in the suite of Newsweek's Jane Brumley. Thompson should stop by, he said. It was an amazing opportunity, especially for a newcomer like Thompson, the chance to drink privately with a group of campaign insiders. Later that night, when Thompson arrived at Brumley's room, an enormous jug of Old Crow whiskey tucked under his arm, one of the first people he saw was the very same aide who'd challenged him in the lobby, the young Pat Buchanan. What could he do? He walked over and offered to share his whiskey. Buchanan, as it turned out, was an Old Crow fan himself. He happily accepted. At the time, he happened to be enjoying his very first date with another Nixon staffer, Shelley Scarney, his future wife. And together, the three of them struck up a conversation. Buchanan had worked for the editorial department at the St. Louis Globe Democrat before entering politics. His current role amounted to a combination of policy advisor, speechwriter, press secretary. In the run-up to New Hampshire, he'd been one of the main architects behind the new Nixon approach, a strategy that, with the help of Madison Avenue veterans and a talk show producer named Roger Ailes, then only 28 years old, sought to counter the candidate's existing image by manipulating, in Nixon's favor, the television camera's inherent capacity for distortion. The goal was to create, via controlled shorts and regional ad spots and pre-edited news segments, the illusion of a mellow, forward-looking, unselfish patriot eager to offer the country the stability it so desperately needed. Someone who, in Buchanan's words, was actually enjoying the hell out of this campaign. Which led to the second aspect of this strategy. I would, right now, lock into only the minimum necessary appearances in New Hampshire, Buchanan wrote in an internal memo. The crowd in that Holiday Inn suite was surprisingly dynamic. In addition to staffers, there were also beat reporters and bureau chiefs. As the night wore on, the conversation turned to the question of what it really felt like to participate in a major political campaign, the adrenaline rush that both journalists and staffers had come to know well. It makes everything else I've done seem pretty dull, Nick Rui admitted. Thompson could understand. After all, the various people in this room weren't necessarily that different. their moral, societal views aside. They'd simply been more effective at manipulating their access to the political mechanism that shaped the world around them. Which prompted another question. What role might he play as a journalistic insider to affect the course of the electoral process he was now participating in for the first time from a backstage perspective? At the end of the evening, after everyone else had gone to bed, Hunter Thompson and Pat Buchanan continued to drink from the enormous jug of whiskey. They stayed up arguing about communism, about Vietnam, and about the best manner in which to respond to what both political parties saw as America's one true enemy, the Union of Soviet Socialist Republics. At this point, the Tet Offensive, a massive countrywide surprise attack by the North Vietnamese, had been raging for 2 weeks. Buchanan towed the establishment line. Once a domino like Vietnam went down, the rest would shortly fall, which meant that the only option besides a preemptive nuclear strike was containment. You had to win the war in Southeast Asia and then do your best to avoid getting drawn into the next one. For Thompson, the real threat to the United States wasn't the Soviet Union. It was the extent to which we appeared all too willing to sacrifice our inalienable rights to support a foolish and clearly doomed militaristic enterprise. A war that in the upcoming election, both parties would use to their benefit at the cost of more and more American lives. Each spoke passionately. Each saw through the other's rhetoric. Each could predict the next line of attack, the facts and gestures and corollaries that were, to anyone who cared about the issue, well known. Still, Thompson was struck by the honesty with which Buchanan employed and defended and recalibrated his shitty containment argument. This young Republican staffer believed the line of reasoning he kept spouting because it was what he needed to believe if Nixon had a shot at winning. Not that this kept them from bolstering their arguments with shouts and the occasional insult. To quote Fitzgerald, each disapproved of the other from beginning to end. As the sun came up on the bare New Hampshire morning, they were still talking heatedly. Many years later, reflecting at different points on his relationship with Pat Buchanan, Hunter Thompson would say, "If nothing else, he's absolutely honest in his lunacy, and I've found during my admittedly limited experience in political reporting that power and honesty rarely coincide." From the night they'd first met, he'd learned an important lesson. You can deal with the system a lot easier if you use their rules. By understanding their rules, by using their rules against them. Thompson had arrived in Manchester that February, ready to write the article his editors expected, a brutal takedown of the politician he judged to be the worst in recent American history, a man who for the last 2 decades had revealed again and again his willingness to sacrifice his ideals in order to gain the most power possible. "Richard Nixon has never been one of my favorite people," he'd state in his eventual pageant feature. "For years, I've regarded his very existence as a monument to all the rancid genes and broken chromosomes that corrupt the possibilities of the American dream. He was a foul caricature of himself, a man with no soul, no inner convictions, with the integrity of a hyena and the style of a poisoned toad." However, during his week at the Manchester Holiday Inn, Thompson couldn't help but notice the behind-the-scenes effort of Nixon's staff. The backstage, mechanical, seemingly trivial stuff, the silent, or at least unpublicized, mechanics of the campaign. To sell such historic foulness under a fresh, rebranded premise. He continued to have run-ins with Henry Hyde, that beefy former Gear and Sprocket salesman from Chicago. At an afternoon taping session at a Manchester television station, Nixon was there to make a series of commercials. Hyde stared menacingly at Thompson the entire time. At another point, Hyde let himself into Thompson's hotel room and read through his typed-up notes. And when Thompson asked about the candidate's image, Had Nixon hired a public relations firm for the primary? Hyde flat out lied. That's not his style. Mr. Nixon runs his own campaigns. Thompson also interviewed Ray Price, the campaign's principal speechwriter. Together, they talked about the candidate's Vietnam strategy, which seemed straight out of the Johnson-Rusk handbook, though with the additional caveat that Nixon shouldn't be expected to say what he really feels, because any such honest declaration would undermine his ability to bargain down the road for what the campaign liked to call peace with honor. To Thompson, it was clear from the start. Richard Nixon's position on Vietnam was to articulate whatever position he believed would win the election, which wasn't really a surprise. After all, it was Price who'd written in an internal campaign memo dated November 28, 1967, "It's not what's there that counts, it's what's projected. It's not the man we have to change, but rather the received impression. And this impression often depends more on the medium and its use than it does on the candidate himself." Price had then copied out passages from Marshall McLuhan's Understanding Media and sent them to the staff. Throughout that week in New Hampshire, Richard Nixon rarely mingled with the reporters who'd gathered there to follow him. Occasionally, at a speech on the campus of the University of New Hampshire or at a town hall VFW stump, the candidate flickered into view. But at best, he was a purposeful shadow. His presence evoked, with the ghost-flat physicality of a dream narrative, the idealized sort of character that his television and print advertisements were in the process of making real. Instead, Thompson continued to strike up relationships with members of the press and staff. He caught up with the New York Times' Bob Semple, whom he'd known from his National Observer days, and he was introduced to the Boston Globe's Bill Cardoso for the first time. He also headed across town to the Wayfarer and took stock of the Democratic primary, Senator Eugene McCarthy's anti-war challenge to Lyndon Johnson's all-but-assured nomination. At night, he drank whiskey with Nick Rui and Pat Buchanan. Eventually, he went so far as to inquire about the possibility of speaking directly with the candidate, an especially difficult proposition. Richard Nixon, in addition to his general dislike of the press, was wary of freelancers who blew into town for only a week at a time. But Rui and Buchanan and Thompson appeared to genuinely enjoy these late-night drinking sessions. Together, they'd exchanged a rare currency, self-awareness from across an ideological divide. And by the end of the week, Buchanan said he'd do his best to arrange some FaceTime with the boss. Not that Thompson's article depended on an interview. Already, he'd begun to structure his narrative around the behind-the-scenes strategy that had dictated the candidate's carefully choreographed lack of a presence. That Friday, February 16, Richard Nixon gave a speech at the Nashua Chamber of Commerce, his final engagement of the week. Afterward, he planned to jet off to Florida with senior staff for a short campaign break. As the event was winding down, Ray Price approached Thompson. "You've been wanting to talk to the boss?" he said. "Okay, come on." Suddenly, they were piling into a large yellow Mercury sedan. Up front, next to Price and Pat Buchanan, a plainclothes cop was driving. It was still too early for a Secret Service detail. The back seat, fortunately, was much roomier, and it was there, on a dim private bench of leather, that Hunter Thompson found himself for the first and only time in his life sitting alongside Richard Milhouse Nixon. The trip from Nashua to Manchester Airport wouldn't have taken more than 30 minutes. Thompson lit a cigarette. Through the smoke-blue darkness, he peered at the figure alongside. What did he see? A nose in profile, shoulders their boneless hunch, cheeks and chin and fleshy jowls, and on top of it all, the famous widow's peak, its solitary head-high thatch. This was the same person who 15 years earlier had looked straight into the television camera and said, "We did get something, a gift, after the election. You know what it was? It was a little Cocker Spaniel dog. And our little girl Tricia, the 6-year-old, named it Checkers, who on the final night of the 1960 Republican convention had the gall to claim, "Yes, yes, I want to say that whatever abilities I have, I got from my mother and my father and my school and my church," who dragged America through the televised tantrum of what he assured us all would be his very last press conference, who then, 2 years later in San Francisco, donned his butcher's son cloak of humility and introduced Barry Goldwater, who'd somehow managed to survive into the late 1960s, like the last mutated member of some long extinct species, adapting just enough while everything around him fell magically into place. A long ribbon of evil luck, spanning John F. Kennedy's assassination, to Goldwater's thumping, to LBJ's Vietnam blunders, to the recent riots, spanning even now, in the deep snow darkness of 1968 New Hampshire, where against all odds, the first primary of the Republican season turned out to lack any real heavyweight challengers. Thompson, after a week in Buchanan's presence, could have probably guessed at Nixon's answers to the usual policy questions. The boss was nothing if not prepared. Instead, as the windows of the Mercury flickered with New Hampshire's landscape, its slick, lightless hills, he decided on another approach. Earlier that night during the speech in Nashua, Richard Nixon had offhandedly mentioned the recent Super Bowl matchup between the Green Bay Packers and Oakland Raiders. He'd expected the Raiders to win, he'd told the audience. And now, in the speeding car, Thompson broke the silence between them with what amounted to a follow-up question. Why bet on AFL champion Oakland instead of Green Bay, the overwhelming favorite? Nixon replied immediately, without any of the caution that marked his public responses. He liked the Raiders because of what Packers coach Vince Lombardi had confided in him up in Green Bay. In the next breath, he added, "The AFL is much stronger than the sports writers claim." For the briefest instant, Thompson felt as if he'd been knocked off balance. A few years earlier, during a similar conversation about football, he'd been told the very same thing by Bob Geiger. At the time, he and Geiger were arguing over which league was better, and long story short, Geiger, a former college quarterback, insisted that AFL teams were more dynamic offensively. They actually pass. And to prove his point, he and Thompson drove out to Frank UL Field, where they watched Oakland take on San Diego in their last home game of the year. It was the first time Hunter Thompson had ever seen pro football live. Sunday, December 21, 1964. After three quarters of back-and-forth drives and balletic catches, the Raiders quarterback Tom Flores fired a last-second pass down the middle, just to the left of the goalpost, that receiver Art Powell somehow corralled for the game-winning touchdown. In the next moment, as the fans streamed onto the field in celebration, Thompson turned to Geiger. The excitement was genuine. He was willing to admit at last that the AFL was just as captivating as its more popular rival. And now, here he was, 4 years later, sitting in the back of a giant yellow Mercury sedan somewhere between Nashua and Manchester, as Richard Nixon talked about football with the unquestioned confidence of an insider. "Oakland didn't fold up," Nixon added, referring to the Super Bowl. "That second half drive had Lombardi worried." Thompson knew exactly what he meant. A series of downs that culminated in a 20-yard pump fake TD pass to little-known receiver Bill Miller. And not quite knowing what to say next, he described the play itself in detail, the dual beauty of its design and execution. Nixon hesitated. For an instant, he seemed preoccupied. Then he smiled. And reaching across the leathery darkness of the Mercury's huge back seat, he tapped Hunter Thompson on the knee. "That's right," he said, laughing. "The Miami boy." Richard Nixon had not only recognized the exact play correctly, He'd actually gone so far as to identify the obscure 27-year-old receiver's college of origin. What followed was an easy, freewheeling conversation. Soon their short ride together was nearly up. In Manchester, they pulled onto the tarmac of the small airport where the Learjet was still fueling. They talked for a bit longer about sports writing, about the success of this recent swing through New Hampshire, even about what it felt like to run for president. "You know," Nixon added, "the worst thing about campaigning for me is that it ruins my whole football season." Thompson lit a cigarette. It had been a week of no sleep, of Dexedrin and Old Crow, and unexpected complexity. From behind the scenes, the American political process appeared to have more in common with a Madison Avenue Coca-Cola campaign than the bare-knuckled tide that had swept through the delegates 4 years earlier on the floor of the San Francisco Cow Palace. And now it was all coming to an end in the wake of a short, surreal car ride through the New Hampshire night, a moment that would, in retrospect, represent the only time in Hunter Thompson's life he would feel comfortable claiming, without a doubt, that the words coming out of Richard Nixon's mouth were true. Finally, the jet was ready for takeoff. Pat Buchanan and Ray Price would be heading to Florida, too, the rest of the campaign staff remaining here. Thompson had been leaning on the wing of the plane, and as he straightened up to offer his goodbyes, he suddenly found himself face to face with advance man Nick Rui, with Rui's expression, a glance that might be best described as a cross between terror and bewilderment and overwhelming panic. Immediately, Thompson became aware of the fuel tank located only a few feet from where he was standing, of the Zippo lighter he was holding in his hand, and of the cigarette that, like a fuse, had been dangling between his lips the entire time. Afterward, after Richard Nixon had been lifted into the night for a weekend of tropical relaxation with his young staffers, Hunter Thompson and Nick Rui drove back to the Holiday Inn for a final drink. "You almost blew up the plane," Rui said. Together, they laughed. But for an advance man like Rui, the whole thing was disconcerting. "What worries me is that nobody else noticed it," he added. "My God, what a nightmare." "I'm sorry," Thompson told him. "I didn't realize I was smoking." Throughout his week at the Holiday Inn, Hunter Thompson had been fascinated by the degree to which a presidential campaign's talented staff could influence, through skill and planning, the public perception of a candidate, of this candidate specifically. In the end, the question he'd arrived in New Hampshire to answer, "Had Richard Nixon changed?" suddenly seemed beside the point. Not that his editors at Pageant saw it this way. They'd expected a surface-level hatchet job, and they had no qualms about chopping up his draft, going so far as to cut 15 of the first 20 pages. Still, the final product, presenting the Richard Nixon doll overhauled 1968 model, would retain clear traces of Thompson's critique, that Nixon's identity is inherently shapeless. "My assignment was to find the man behind all these masks, or maybe to find that there was no mask at all, that Richard Milhouse Nixon, at age 55, was neither more nor less than what he appeared to be, a plastic man in a plastic bag, surrounded by hired wizards so cautious as to seem almost plastic themselves. These political handlers were chosen this time for their coolness and skill, for only one job, to see that Richard Nixon is the next president of the United States." In this sense, should it matter if the truest aspect of the candidate's character was that he liked football? The whole nice guy routine from the car ride only seemed to further reinforce a deeply unsettling implication. What were the limits to a well-organized, behind-the-scenes rehabilitation campaign when the thing being rehabilitated lacked any pretense of conventional, one might even go so far as to say, moral substance? If the electorate found the old version of Richard Nixon to be unappealing and craven and self-serving, Was it possible to use these specific flaws in a manner that advantageously facilitated the rebranding effort? Really, what we're talking about is utility. But in what sense? Would the cumulative efforts of staff members like Price and Buchanan and Rui and Roger Ailes eventually amount to something so effectively novel as to provide the opportunity for pretty much any candidate, no matter how unlovely, to take the presidency? Or conversely, did this specific Madison Avenue approach uniquely play upon the crassest and most venal aspects of Richard Nixon's character, unchaining in the manner of a nuclear reaction the terrible potential that in retrospect had always resided at the dark star heart of this singular American politician? At the end of his pageant article, Hunter Thompson offered a pair of anecdotes. He explained how, during a speech at the University of New Hampshire, Nixon had said, "I'm not a good actor. I can't be phony about it." And then, in his next breath, had told the students that after so many years, his inability to pretend remained one of his biggest political obstacles. "I still refuse to wear makeup," he'd added. This was on Wednesday, February 14. 3 weeks later, Thompson wrote, the same man, after winning the New Hampshire primary, laughingly attributed his victory to the new makeup he'd been wearing. He thought he was being funny, at least on one level, but on another level, he was telling the absolute truth. When Richard Nixon first announced his candidacy for the 1968 nomination on February 2, during an afternoon press conference in the dreary meeting room of the Manchester Holiday Inn, he was still considered a long shot to defeat a sitting president like Lyndon Johnson. The Tet Offensive was only 2 days old then. That morning, a photograph showing an enemy prisoner in mid-execution, his head distending like a poorly fired vase as the bullet broke from one temple to the next, ran on the front page of the New York Times. On February 5, Lyndon Johnson called up Jack Horner of the Washington Star, complaining, "Your press is lying like drunken sailors every day." On February 27, Walter Cronkite, back in the United States after a recent trip to Vietnam, declared, "To say that we are mired in stalemate seems the only realistic, if unsatisfactory, conclusion. But it is increasingly clear to this reporter that the only rational way out then will be to negotiate not as victors, but as an honorable people who lived up to their pledge to defend democracy and did the best they could." That same month, an unidentified American major responding to questions about a massive ordnance strike on the city Bientre was quoted as saying, "It became necessary to destroy the town to save it." On March 10, the Joint Chiefs recommended an additional call-up of 200,000 troops. On March 11, Eugene McCarthy, the patrician 51-year-old anti-war senator from Minnesota, who alone among his party had challenged the president, nearly won the New Hampshire Democratic primary, gaining 42% of the vote. On March 13, Robert Kennedy announced his candidacy. On March 30, a new Gallup poll revealed that most Americans, 63%, disapproved of the way the war was being handled. On March 31, a Sunday evening, Lyndon Baines Johnson addressed the nation about the war. "Tonight I want to speak to you of peace in Vietnam and Southeast Asia." The 30-minute speech concluded with a shocking announcement. "I shall not seek, and I will not accept, the nomination of my party for another term as your president." Hunter Thompson, home in Woody Creek at the time, was incensed. "I really hated to see him quit," he wrote to his brother Jim afterward. "He deserved to be destroyed on his feet." Suddenly, the second book in his contract with Random House was off the table, which meant that as a result of the surprise news, he'd lost a $10,000 advance. Of course, he also recognized the victory. "It was like driving an evil king off the throne," he'd later write. "The next president would be either Gene McCarthy or Bobby Kennedy, and the war would be over by Christmas." 4 days later, on the balcony of the Lorraine Motel in Memphis, Tennessee, Martin Luther King Jr. was shot through the head and killed. Riots broke out across American cities. In Washington, D.C., entire neighborhoods burned. In Baltimore, more than 3,000 people were arrested. Chicago Mayor Richard M. Daley put into place a shoot-to-kill order, authorizing his officers to murder rioters in the streets. From out in California, Oscar Acosta, practicing law again now in East Los Angeles as an attorney for the burgeoning Chicano rights movement, wrote to Thompson, "Once upon a time, I was a liberal. Yesterday, I was a militant. Today, I am a revolutionary, trying like hell not to become uptight. It is not inconceivable that this largest of cities could be on fire before this letter reaches you. I'm scared shitless because the anger within me looks forward to seeing the fear in their faces and the burning." Over the next 2 months, as Nixon continued to dominate the Republican ticket and Kennedy and McCarthy traded victories, Hubert Humphrey, Johnson's vice president, worked to shore up his own candidacy, avoiding the primaries altogether while steadily gathering a large number of unpledged delegates. On June 4, the night of the pivotal California primary, Robert Kennedy defeated McCarthy by a slim margin, 46-42%. Just before midnight Pacific time, he descended in an elevator from his suite at the Ambassador Hotel to address his supporters, who'd gathered in the ballroom. "I want to express gratitude to my dog Freckles, who's been maligned," he said to raucous laughter, before adding, "I'm not doing this in the order of importance, but I also want to thank my wife, Ethel." He went on to acknowledge his campaign staffers in the crowd. "And it's on to Chicago," he concluded. "And let's win this." Then he ducked into a service exit, taking a shortcut through the kitchen corridor to another ballroom, where reporters were waiting to interview him for what was to be the final press conference of the night. Along the way, he was repeatedly stopped and congratulated. Near the ice machine in the kitchen, he shook hands with Juan Romero, a young busboy. Just then, Saran Bashara Saran, a 24-year-old of Palestinian descent who'd been infuriated by Kennedy's support for Israel, emerged from the clutter along the wall and fired multiple shots from a .22-caliber Ivor Johnson cadet revolver. Robert Kennedy was hit at point-blank range behind the right ear. The damage was immediate. With its fluid tail of bone, the first bullet had drawn an irreversible path through his head. Still, for a few miraculous moments, he remained conscious. After the people at his side immobilized the assassin, the writer George Plimpton was there along with two former professional athletes, he was able to ask with startling lucidity if anyone else had been hurt. "Everything's going to be okay," he said. A few minutes later, as he was being moved to a stretcher, he whispered in pain, "Oh, no, no, don't." Then he lost consciousness. At the time, Hunter Thompson was driving home in Woody Creek. He'd been watching the night's events at the house of his friend Peggy Clifford, a columnist for the Aspen Times, when he heard on the radio what had happened. That spring, in a speech at Vanderbilt University, Robert Kennedy had stated, "Our country is in danger, not from foreign enemies so much, but above all from our misguided policies." He quoted Sophocles, "All men make mistakes, but a good man yields when he knows his course is wrong, and then he repairs the error. The only sin is pride." Regarding his possible opponent in the general election, the current Republican frontrunner, he added, "Richard Nixon represents the dark side of the American spirit." Thompson loved this characterization. That March, he wrote a letter to Ted Sorensen, Kennedy's informal counselor, and offered his services to the campaign. "All I really want to do is get that evil pig fucker out of the White House and not let Nixon in, and the only real hope I see right now is your friend Robert. So maybe I can write something for you. That's the only thing I do better than most people, so I guess that's what I should offer." On the road to Woody Creek that June night, Thompson turned around and headed back to Clifford's. There, with other Aspen residents, he watched the coverage on ABC. "We've heard an alarming report that Robert Kennedy was shot," news anchor Howard Smith said. "A very loud noise like a clap of thunder was heard, a small explosion." By dawn, there was still nothing definitive to report.
"It won't be like the last time," Thompson told Clifford.
But it was happening all over again. A day later, Robert Kennedy was dead. And in the face of this latest assassination, the second that spring, Hunter Thompson experienced a fresh surge of the terror that had been visited upon him and so many others a half decade earlier. Except now, as opposed to the urgency that had hit him in the wake of JFK's murder, he felt, in a word, helpless. If so much had happened already, what could possibly be next? The Battle of Michigan Avenue. Imagine for a moment, as if from above, from the lake, its surface like a great mineral disk, the Midwest's one true 20th century metropolis, Chicago, late summer 1968, a city in all its broken jawbone glory. Wednesday, August 28. After a week of violent skirmishes, the Democratic National Convention had been reduced to a grid of north-south checkpoints. Lincoln Park, Grant Park, the hotels at the Loop, and then four straight miles of Michigan Avenue before a final hard jog west to Halstead and the International Amphitheater, an old rib-roofed arena with a 9,000-seat capacity standing like a shipwreck against the dirty stockyards beyond. Already the convention was in its third day. That afternoon, Hunter Thompson was on his way back from the delegate-filled amphitheater, where he just watched the crushing conclusion to the party's debate over its official position on the war in Vietnam. The minority viewpoint, a resolution sponsored by Senator Eugene McCarthy and former presidential speechwriter Richard Goodwin, received spirited defenses from former members of the Kennedy campaign. "We are not outside the mainstream of the Democratic Party," Ted Sorensen implored. "We agree with the voters of every Democratic primary. Stop the war." Speechwriter Pierre Salinger went so far as to invoke his murdered boss's name. "If Senator Robert Kennedy were alive, he would be on this platform speaking for the minority." But the Hawks, their position advocated by the likes of Maine Senator Ed Muskie, managed to carry the final delegate vote. By 3 p.m., it was over. The Humphrey-Johnson resolution won out. For months, Hubert Humphrey had been relying on the full support of the party machine to secure delegates. In 1968, many states still didn't hold primaries, and those that did weren't always required to pledge them to the winners, which meant that under the rules at the time, a candidate pretty much needed to sweep the entire run-up to the convention if they hoped to avoid a backroom challenge. But the vigorous McCarthy-Kennedy matchup had split the anti-war wing. In the wake of June's unthinkable assassination, amid calls for stability and order, Humphrey quickly outflanked Eugene McCarthy to secure the nomination. He was, after all, the nation's vice president, LBJ's right-hand man and chosen successor. He was also deeply distrusted by the party's anti-war crowd. Everyone knew there was no way he'd go against the Vietnam policy of an outgoing leader whose support had done so much to secure him his position in the first place. Thompson had left the amphitheater to attend a rally in Grant Park, a narrow stretch of waterside grass that was divided from Michigan Avenue and the convention's main hotels by a sunken channel of railroad tracks. To get there, you had to cross a street bridge connecting the Loop and the lakefront. It was just after 4 p.m. He was on foot. His destination, the park's bandshell, was the gathering point for the rally, which was shaping up to be the largest of the week. But on the Balboa Street Bridge, he suddenly found himself face to face with a row of Chicago police officers. He reached for the press pass at his neck, a
a document that he'd worked with Jim Silberman at Random House throughout the summer to acquire, and he was walking in mid-stride when he showed it to them. He was grabbed from behind. "That's not a press pass," a cop snarled. Thompson, struggling, showed the document again. "What the hell do you think it is?" For an instant, he was free, no longer being held. Then he felt himself violently struck in the gut, just above the belt. He fell to the ground. The cop had speared him with a billy club, using both hands, as if to drive his stomach out between the lowest knuckles of his spine. He got back on his feet and retreated to his hotel, the Sheraton Blackstone located alongside the Hilton, a few blocks away at the intersection of Michigan and Balbo, where, trying to catch his breath, he changed into running shoes. He also grabbed his motorcycle helmet. At Grant Park, the 15,000-person rally Thompson had hoped to reach was already coming undone. That week, the protests had been coordinated by two central groups: the nonviolence advocating National Mobilization Committee to End the War in Vietnam, MOBE, and the more confrontational Yippies. And for the event at the Bandshell, they'd obtained a legal permit. But Mayor Richard Daley adamantly refused to allow a march. The permit was only for Grant Park. And earlier in the day, he'd assigned 600 cops to the Bandshell area to keep everyone there in place. At first, things went smoothly. A series of notable speakers addressed the audience, which, in addition to the thousands of young men and women who'd come from all over the country to speak out against Vietnam, also included an older, more mainstream contingent. But there was an incident near the flagpole. A teenager spontaneously decided to climb up it, and a phalanx of police, seeing this, charged and split the crowd, clubbing everyone in their way. During the confusion that ensued, the gathering was declared an illegal assembly, and the cops moved in to clear the entire park. The thousands of protesters tried to flee, but to their horror, they realized they were trapped. Earlier in the afternoon, the National Guard, summoned by Daley, had taken up positions at the park's exits. With machine guns and rifles and bayonets, they blocked the limited number of bridges spanning the railroad tracks to Michigan Avenue. And now, in the chaos, they fired repeated volleys of CN tear gas from their powerful Army-issued launchers. In desperation, the protesters, beaten and bloodied, surged toward these choke points. Eventually, the guardsmen and police fell back, overwhelmed. Around that time, Hunter Thompson had reemerged from his hotel. He was standing near the entrance to the Hilton. A few blocks to his north, the mass of fleeing protesters regrouped at Michigan Avenue. Together, they began to make their way south, toward the stockyards. But their general progression was extremely slow. It took almost an hour to cross just a few blocks. In the meantime, the cops reformed at Michigan and Balbo, where the two main conference hotels were located. And to the south and west and east, they established a deep perimeter. They planned to stop the march there before it had a chance to get anywhere near the International Amphitheater, located 4 miles to the south. So the situation was this. Over the next hour, 7,000 protesters slowly penned themselves into this four-way urban intersection, onto which the Lakeview Suites of both the Sheraton Blackstone and the 29-story Conrad Hilton looked down. Rooms inhabited at the time by the Democratic Party's most prominent leaders. The crowd stood shoulder to shoulder, singing songs and chanting slogans. "Hell no, we won't go," and "Stop the war, stop the war," and "Dump the hump," and "Fuck you, LBJ," and to the cops, "Sieg Heil." From across the city, evening was coming on. A late summer twilight, arid and clear, the Chicago skyline throwing its long tusks of shadow toward the lake. Thompson, his motorcycle helmet stowed in the large blue kit bag at his shoulder, had taken up a position against the windows of the Hilton's ground-level restaurant, the Haymarket Inn, where from behind a row of yellow police barricades, he and other journalists stood alongside a number of Democratic staffers and delegates who'd come down from their rooms with their spouses to see what was going on. Just before 8 p.m., Deputy Superintendent James Roquefort, the on-site commander in charge of convention security, received word that additional reinforcements had begun to arrive, along with a contingent of paddy wagons to transport prisoners. And to the officers gathered around and off the perimeter, he gave the order: clear the intersection. The Chicago police approached from both ends of Michigan and Balbo in tight military formation. Then they broke into a full run, charging into the crowd, attacking everyone. They swung their billy clubs with overhand strokes in the way you would through lumber, releasing their weapons down onto the heads of their targets. They were wearing sky blue helmets with thick black chin straps. For the most part, they were young men from Irish and Polish and German and Italian families. Before the assault, they'd taken off their badges and nameplates. They knew that the order to attack had been delayed over half an hour, deliberated upon. And once the word came down through the chain of command, arriving like a small sum of money or an equally modest fine, there could be no doubting that it represented the official position of Chicago's highest civilian authorities. A new round of tear gas volleys shrouded the intersection. In the burning fog, you could hear clubs striking bone, panicked footsteps, and screams, their orchestral pain. A breeze came up from the lake. It was night. A new wave of cops arrived. Together they chanted, "Kill, kill, kill," an incantation as they approached the intersection. The protesters tried to flee. "Hey," a young man with a mustache said, "God damn!" A cop had doubled him over with a club to the gut and was tossing him into one of the paddy wagons. At that moment, a television camera was filming these wagons, and now this cop turned and attacked him too. A doctor in a white coat and Red Cross armband ran to help and was knocked to the ground by pairs of police who kept beating him as he tried to crawl away. There were plain-clothes cops, white-shirted cops. Some had antennas at their back to relay radio instructions. Others wore long black jackets with chevrons at the shoulders. A few were on three-wheeled motorcycles, one of whom could be heard as he ran people over, shouting, "Wahoo!" Desperate for cover, a young man, at most 17, sprinted for the Hilton's side entrance. Four cops followed closely at his heels. From under the hotel awning, Fred Dutton, a former presidential advisor who until June had directed Robert Kennedy's campaign, placed himself between the kid and the police. "He's my guest in this hotel," Dutton said. The police threw the young man down and began clubbing him. Fred Dutton was 45 years old. He'd worked as a senior aide in John F. Kennedy's administration and written speeches for Lyndon Johnson. In World War II, he'd been a prisoner of the Germans and was awarded a Bronze Star and Purple Heart after being wounded during the Battle of the Bulge. 2 months earlier, he'd been standing in the kitchen of the Ambassador Hotel when the shots rang out. On the way to the hospital, he'd ridden beside Ethel Kennedy in the back of the ambulance, the two of them watching helplessly as Bobby, unconscious after so much loss of blood, struggled to breathe, his pulse fading. Dutton shouted at the Chicago police to stop. He demanded their names and badge numbers. One of the cops broke off and charged at him. He was knocked down and grabbed and pulled out into the street. The cop dragged him toward the paddy wagon. It wasn't until a reporter for the Washington Post ran out and explained just who it was being carried off that this cop finally let go and melted away back into the violence. "Sadism and brutality," Dutton screamed after him. To the journalists standing nearby, he implored, "Report all this." Richard Goodwin, the RFK aide who that afternoon had co-sponsored the convention's defeated peace platform, appeared beside him. and together they help direct the wounded into the hotel lobby. "This is just the beginning," Goodwin said. On the fourth floor of the Sheraton Blackstone, South Dakota Senator George McGovern, the party's most consistent critic of the war, watched from his window. A year earlier, in a speech republished by the New York Times, he'd proclaimed, "Our deepening involvement in Vietnam represents the most tragic and diplomatic moral failure in our national experience." Now, he turned furiously to the others in his suite. "Do you see what those sons of bitches are doing to those kids down there?" As he and his staff looked on, a volunteer for their campaign, a young woman who had earlier been asked to deliver some files to the Hilton, crossed the intersection and was attacked by a cop. McGovern watched helplessly as the baton struck her directly in the face, shattering her teeth, her mouth filling with blood. On the 15th floor of the Hilton, Eugene McCarthy set up an emergency medical station to treat the injured protesters who were streaming into the lobby. Many of his young anti-war supporters and staffers had been in the park and on Michigan Avenue. On the 19th floor, Pat Buchanan, in Chicago to act as Nixon's eyes and ears, stood at the window alongside two unexpected guests. A short while earlier, he'd been alone in his suite when through the doorway, Norman Mailer suddenly appeared, looking for a drink. Mailer was accompanied by the boxer Jose Torres, former light heavyweight champion, and the three had just sat down to cocktails. "I'm more of a left conservative," Mailer was in the process of explaining when they heard a loud bang from the street below. Now, standing side by side, they watched it all. "Sons of bitches! Sons of bitches!" Torres shouted at the cops. Mailer took it in silently. Later, he'd write, "The military spine of the great liberal party had finally separated itself from its skin. It opened the specter of what it might mean for the police to take over society." Buchanan also didn't speak. Instantly, he understood what the violence meant. His boss had just become the odds-on favorite to win the presidency of the United States. 3 weeks earlier, during the Republican convention in Miami, Richard Nixon had played it perfectly. On violence, "As we look at America, we see cities enveloped in smoke and flame. We hear sirens in the night. We see Americans dying on distant battlefields abroad. We see Americans hating each other, fighting each other, killing each other at home. Did we come all this way for this?" On stability, "Listen to the answer. It is another voice. It is the quiet voice in the tumult and the shouting. It is the voice of the great majority of Americans, the forgotten Americans, the non-shouters, the non-demonstrators." And on his signature theme, "The first civil right of every American is to be free from domestic violence. And to those who say that law and order is the code word for racism, and here is a reply, our goal is justice for every American." Buchanan wouldn't balk at manipulating what was happening on the street, even if he knew that such a line of attack contradicted the reality he was witnessing. Afterward, his report to Nixon would be unequivocal. "We belonged on the side of Mayor Daley and the Chicago cops. That was where our future interests lay. It was where the politics of the day pointed us." Now they had their attack line for the general election. Humphrey was nothing more than an out-of-touch party hack who couldn't even unite the Democrats, let alone the country. Six more floors up at the top of the Conrad Hilton in 2525A, an enormous suite packed with red flowers and multiple color televisions and plates of his favorite cheese sandwiches, Hubert Horatio Humphrey had gathered with his staff. But unlike everyone else, he'd only glanced at the violence, choosing instead to work in another room on his acceptance speech. Suddenly, his nose started itching. It was the faintest whiff of tear gas, sucked in from the air conditioning vents. After another quick glance at the window, the battle of Michigan Avenue had been raging now for 15 unbelievable minutes. He retreated to the suite's bathroom, where he took a shower. The entire time, Hunter Thompson had been standing behind the yellow barricades with his back to Hilton's ground floor restaurant, watching it all up close. Throughout the week, he'd seen the violence spread. Each night in Lincoln Park, the police had attacked the protesters sleeping there, and afterward, the surrounding streets had filled with running skirmishes. On the convention floor, CBS correspondent Dan Rather had been punched and thrown to the ground by security guards during a live broadcast when he tried to speak with an anti-war delegate. Late Tuesday night, Daley had called in the National Guard. The city had also put into place multiple undercover officers dressed like hippies who would throw bottles or bricks toward the cops, which then gave the police the justification to respond with overwhelming force. Thompson and the other journalists were still surrounded by older party officials and their wives. From the start, it had been the safest spot. Initially, there'd been chance of the whole world is watching. But now, they were silent. The cops, taking control of the intersection, were preparing a new assault. On Michigan Avenue, from both the north and the south, two fresh lines of police were advancing. They came together at the Hilton, a classic pincer formation, and the street's remaining protesters, perhaps 500, suddenly had nowhere to go. The cops kept pressing them back in the direction of the hotel, its floor-level restaurant, the exact spot where Thompson and the others were standing. Now the officers charged. They sprayed mace from handheld cans and came in fast behind the wet, fogging bursts. The protesters surged back over the barricade. Thompson was forced against the Hilton. "Stay together, stay together," some of them were shouting. A few tried to break through the line in groups, but they were quickly separated and beaten. The cordon was complete. Half a thousand people were pinned against the plate glass windows of the Conrad Hilton Hotel. The police gathered again and blitzed their final assault. Thompson reached frantically for the motorcycle helmet in his bag. He slipped it on just as the cops got to him, bodies at his back and at his feet. And then the overhand blow, the billy club coming down on his motorcycle helmet, a plastic and leather dome that would have amplified into his ears the deafening bang. At the same time, it had protected his skull and brain, which meant that unlike the other concussed men and women lying around him, he could still register with all his faculties intact the unmistakable message. The civic authorities were using indiscriminate violence to silence their legitimate political opposition and journalistic observers. Thompson knew immediately that if they were willing to do this, if on national television the rights inherent to the Constitution of the United States could be completely and unequivocally discarded, then they could do anything. From behind, he heard a new crash. Now the crowd was being forced through the Haymarket's plate glass window, which loudly shattered. Men and women tumbled helplessly down into the restaurant. The police followed them in, leaping, clubs drawn. Thompson was a few feet away. Around him, the cops shoved past. What was happening to the people who only minutes before were standing next to him? Were they down there now on the ruthless glass-strewn floor of the Haymarket? Who was dying and who was safe? Was it only a matter of time until he'd be next? Suddenly, he was sure he was about to be hit by a hail of bullets fired from above, from the rooftop, the shot exploding in his chest before he even heard its report. There was nothing he could do. "I have never been caught in an earthquake," he'd say about this moment, "but I'm sure the feeling would be just about the same. Total panic and disbelief, with no escape." Something was coming that he couldn't see, speeding toward him from the menace of the night. At that instant, pinned against the shattered wall of the Haymarket, he was overcome with the terror and paralysis and regret of what it means to be hit and then, as if in a nightmare, go down. It was the sort of fear Bobby Kennedy had been made to feel 2 months earlier during those waning minutes on the Ambassador Kitchen's concrete floor, when he could still ask if everyone else was okay, aware that his life was leaving him, but helpless to do anything but watch it go. We're talking about the saddest moment of all, the one in which you finally realize you're beyond everyone else's reach. Inside the Hilton, a protester with a severed neck artery was slumped against the wall. Another, his legs paralyzed, crawled on his elbows. The cops beat them anyway, beating the diners who'd been sitting in the Haymarket too. Then they moved on to the lobby. "Clear the floor," one of them shouted. By now, they didn't care about arresting people. The intersection was secure. Just then, Hunter Thompson saw an opening. Through the remaining crowd of police and wounded protesters, he sprinted to the Blackstone about 60 feet away, where the cops near the entrance clubbed him back. "I live here, goddammit," he screamed. "I'm paying $50 a day." He was shoved into the door. He pulled out his room key and waved it overhead until finally someone let him push through into the lobby. In his room, he locked and chained his door. His eyes burned. His clothes stank with chemicals. His gut ached. But he was unharmed. He wet a cloth and held it carefully to his face to soak out the tear gas. Then he sat on the bed, his legs crossed. His entire body was shaking. He couldn't write. None of it made sense. The whole week, the police had known that he was a member of the press, that the men and women they'd forced through the Haymarket window were political officials, that a number of the nonviolent young protesters worked as campaign staffers for Democratic candidates. But then, that was the horrific point. Years later, looking back on this moment, he'd write, "These bastards knew my position, and they wanted to beat me anyway. They were powerful enough to break anybody who even thought about getting in their way." What I learned in Chicago was that the police arm of the United States government was capable of hiring vengeful thugs to break the very rules we all thought we were operating under. The violence he'd just witnessed was clearly state-sanctioned, political, fascistic, and it had originated within the core electoral processes of the democratic system it now threatened. In this sense, we were its authors and performers, and intended audience. All along, this violence had been with us, was us. A song for America we'd been singing from the start. It was just after 9 p.m. Down at the amphitheater, the balloting for the nomination was about to begin. Thompson still had his press pass. It had been around his neck the entire time. And he planned to put it to use now for something other than an invitation to a beating. In 1968, the Chicago International Amphitheater was like an old Roman grandstand that for millennia had somehow managed to escape the fire. Its balconies hung right over the floor. Its lower gallery could only be accessed through a maze of narrow tunnels. Its carpets were red. Its speaker's podium employed the same sky blue theme as the Chicago Police Department. "Promises kept," the facade read. Here, for an entire week, the Democrats had sat on top of one another, arguing over the nature of their shipwrecked fate. And now, on Wednesday night, nominating night, they were ready for an all-out fight. In retrospect, one of Mayor Daley's most effective tactics had been preemptive. Before the convention, he'd helped orchestrate an electrical workers' strike, which had the cumulative effect of preventing the networks from broadcasting live at any Chicago locations other than the amphitheater. As a result, the cameras on hand for the police riot at Michigan and Balbo all contained film, which meant they still needed to be developed and cut, a time-intensive process. And for an hour and a half, the footage remained unseen. At 9:30, David Brinkley interrupted the nominating process to say, "The tape you're about to see was made 30 or 40 minutes ago." Throughout the floor, many of the delegates and aides and congressional leaders who'd been at the amphitheater all evening were learning about the violence for the first time. By this point, Hunter Thompson had made his way to the press balcony, its precipitous apron where, wild-eyed and stinking, the tear gas still in his skin, he watched the proceedings. When the Alabama delegation, led by infamous 71-year-old Birmingham segregationist Bull Connor, nominated the football coach Bear Bryant for president, Thompson started bellowing down at them, "Martin Bormann," the name of Adolf Hitler's personal secretary and Nazi Party Obergruppenführer, who for years had been rumored to have escaped Argentina. "Martin Bormann! Martin Bormann! Martin Bormann! Martin Bormann!" he screamed at the delegates, many of them close enough to hear. In a letter a few weeks later, he described the moment. "The Jesuit priest sitting next to me kept me from hurling my binoculars, and Daley's thugs sitting all around me luckily didn't know who Martin Bormann is/was. Down on the floor, the convention chair, Carl Albert, an old little Oklahoman with a very big gavel, kept trying to move things along. But by now, word of the Battle of Michigan Avenue had spread through the delegates. A few rows back, Mayor Richard Daley was sitting with the Illinois delegation. He was approaching 70, balding and fleshy, his purple lips locked tightly together. A man who'd spent his entire adult life in politics, who in 1960 had helped Jack Kennedy take Illinois, and with it, the presidency, who'd opened the convention on Monday by saying, "As long as I am mayor of this city, there is going to be law and order in Chicago," who'd supported Hubert Humphreys since the spring over the likes of Bobby Kennedy, because Vietnam aside, this year it was the vice president's turn. He was the last unquestioned party boss the Democrats would see. Powerful enough under the current allocation system to swing the delegates loyal to him in such a way as to determine the future of the country itself. That night, as news of the violence spread, Lyndon Johnson, watching